London, and also senior analyst from the Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, out of New York. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen, and thanks for following this edition of The Debate.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم إن ربكم الله الذي خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا و ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية إنه لا يحب المعتدين. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top stories: the U.S. president expresses concern about the growing ties between Iran and China days after Tehran and Beijing signed the strategic cooperation agreement. The UN chief criticizes developed countries for what he calls very unfair distribution of coronavirus vaccines in the world. Also in the headlines, authorities in Mozambique say dozens of people were killed in a militant attack on a besieged northern town this week. Welcome. The U.S. president has expressed concern over the newly signed Iran-China Comprehensive Partnership Agreement.
How concerning is the emerging partnership between China and Iran?
I've been concerned about that for a year.
Biden made the comment in an address to reporters in the U.S. city of Wilmington. Tehran and Beijing signed a cooperation pact dubbed the Sino-Iranian Strategic Partnership. The deal was signed during a visit by China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi to Iran. The agreement includes cooperation in political, strategic, and economic fields. The pact would see Iran supply China with oil for 25 years. In return, China would invest in Iran's ports as well as banking and telecom sectors. Commentator Brian Berletic says the Iran-China agreement is aimed at standing against U.S. pressure on the two countries.
I think it shouldn't come as much of a surprise that nations like Iran or China or Russia, for that matter, would begin working together. These are all nations that seek good ties with nations all around the globe. And now with this pressure on them from the United States, it only makes sense for them to all work together specifically regarding this pressure. So I think for the U.S. president to say that he's worried about countries cooperating around the globe, that's a strange thing to say. It's a strange thing to hear a president of a country that poses as a global leader condemning cooperation. And it's constructive cooperation at that. So It's a promising sign from China and Iran, and it's troubling to see America's reaction to it.
Iraq's parliament requested the U.S. troops in Iraq be withdrawn over a year ago. Now, an Iraqi lawmaker says the legislature will take new measures if talks with the U.S. planned for April do not lead to a pullout. We earlier discussed that issue in our news review program.
Our news review segment, where we take a look at one of our stories in more detail. Now, an Iraqi lawmaker says Parliament will take a new position if upcoming talks with the U.S. do not lead to the withdrawal of American forces from the country. Khatib al-Rikabi is a member of the Iraqi Parliament Security and Defense Committee. He said there has been no firm statement from U.S. officials on the withdrawal of American forces since the Iraqi parliament called for the pullout. He said that is concerning. Iraqi lawmakers voted for the pullout of American forces in January 2020. That came after a U.S. drone strike near Baghdad killed top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes. Iraqis have held protests on various occasions against the presence of U.S. forces in their country. Joining us is David Yerubian, a professor of history, and we also have Romero Funes, a political commentator. Gentlemen, welcome. David, you know the U.S. argument for its military presence in Iraq is to train the local Iraqi army. But the last time against Daesh, the last time Daesh came to town, the U.S. trained Iraqi army did a fabulous job. They all fled. You know, you had the commanders fled, ghost soldiers, if you recall, leaving foot soldiers to the slaughterhouses. Enter Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and his small team of military advisors who taught Iraqi military commanders something about bravery on the battlefield. So I'm guessing my question is, and that's something that allowed Daesh to collapse in such a short time. So why not bring back the professionals? Of course, America assassinated Iran's war hero, General Qasem Soleimani, but there are others. Should Iraq need assistance, it could ask its neighbor for professional advice, not a country some 11,000, I think, kilometers away.
I believe that the purpose of the maintenance of U.S. troops in Iraq is not to provide for Iraqi security, either in the short or the long term, and specifically against the forces of ISIS, which the United States, through its invasion and occupation of Iraq, and as well the setting up of the military that you mentioned, and essentially the staging of material for the Takfiri terrorists of ISIS to pick up in their assault on both the people and governments of Syria as well as Iraq. This is part of the plan to maintain U.S. forces in Iraq as long as possible to continue the destabilization of Syria, to continue its presence in Iraq, as President Trump pretty frankly said, to watch Iran, as he stated. And so this is a part of the plan. The training of what, as you described, was an ineffective Iraqi military that therefore necessitated the return of U.S. forces in 2014 to take care of the Takfiri mess that they had created. And we know this through the DIA documents from 2012, from the statements of John Kerry, from the Hillary Clinton and John Podesta emails. And so to the direct topic of the upcoming strategic talks between the United States and the Iraqi government, I think it's imperative that the United States sets out a very clear and brief timetable for the withdrawal of its forces, so that ultimately Iraqi and optimally Syrian security can finally be obtained.
Romero, some resistance leaders in the country say even passing the Iraqi parliament passed a bill to essentially calling for the U.S. to withdraw. They say even that was a mistake because it's clearly written in Iraq's constitution that an occupation is prohibited. And now some say, well, you know, it's not an occupation. How is it not an occupation when you have combat troops on the ground? You got warplanes using Iraqi airspace without, consent from Baghdad, killing Iraqi security forces on Iraqi soil without facing the country's judicial system. The list is endless.
That's exactly right. I think we have to frame this as what it is, which is an occupation, an imperialist occupation by the United States. We have Anthony Blinken, who is the Secretary of State under the Joe Biden administration, who comes from a long line of war hawks, of people who believe that the United States has a role to police the globe, to make sure that countries fall under their domination. In this case, their role is a little different. I think the Biden administration, the Democrats, they maintain the same policies as the Republicans of invasion, of occupation. However, they do it under the name of human rights. They do it under the name of advancing humanity, which we know is a complete lie. Anywhere the United States has stepped foot has only gotten worse, Iraq being a great example of that after 2003. We're talking about one of the oldest and most beautiful civilizations in human history, Iraq, where the birthplace of Babylon, of Ur, of so many ancient beautiful civilizations, and has such a wealth of resources, and is also geopolitically located in a very key area. The U.S. does not want to uplift Iraq. The U.S. does not want to empower Iraq. The U.S. wants to maintain Iraq under perpetual occupation, because if we take a look at a map of Iraq, where is it located? It's located right between Iran and Syria, right between what connects East Asia and South Asia with the Mediterranean. Now, for the U.S., for Israel, for Saudi Arabia, in any way, if Iraq joins and develops with Iran, which it was trying to do, that's what the Iraqi people want. They want to grow. They want to prosper. They want to build hospitals. They want to connect the One Belt, One Road initiative. They want to trade with Syria and Iran. Now, if Iraq does that, that is a very big threat to Israel. That is a very big threat to the United States, to Saudi Arabia, who have investments to make sure that Iraq remains perpetually destroyed, perpetually occupied. It's the missing link in the axis of resistance to imperialism in the region. And I think that unfortunately, the U.S. will do whatever it can to make sure it maintains that occupation.
Okay, gentlemen, good discussion. Let's thank our guests for their time. David Rubiana, professor of history, and we also had Romero Funes, political commentator. And that brings an end to this edition of the News Review.
Okay, let's move on with the rest of the stories we have for you this hour. The Secretary of States of the United States threatens Russia with consequences over what he calls Moscow's malign activity against Washington. Antony Blinken says the U.S. will take steps to defend its interests whenever it chooses to. He highlighted a shared commitment among U.S. and its Western allies to hold Russia accountable for its actions. Washington has refused to participate in virtual talks with Moscow to discuss their tensions after President Biden called his Russian counterpart a killer. The U.S. accuses Russia of cyber attacks and of meddling in the November presidential election that Joe Biden won. Moscow dismissed the allegations. Ties between the U.S. and Russia have been tense, with several tit-for-tat actions taken against one another. The United Nations Secretary General criticizes developed countries for creating a stockpile of COVID-19 vaccines, calling on them to share with the rest of the world. Antonio Guterres said he was very concerned with very unfair distribution of vaccines in the world. A UN chief slammed the self-interest of rich countries for building up vaccine supplies beyond the needs of their populations. He lamented that the COVAX international system of vaccine aid to disadvantaged countries is having difficulties because, quote, there's been a lot of hoarding. Guterres was also cautious about the notion of vaccination passports. He added that such a system would be devastating if people could move within the developed world but not within the developing world. Australian authorities have announced the coronavirus lockdown in the capital of Queensland state, Brisbane, to contain an outbreak of the UK variant there.
I can report that we've had 10 new cases overnight, 6 are overseas acquired, and we have 4 community transmission. 2, we will have to go into a 3-day lockdown. This is the UK strain. It is highly infectious. That lockdown will commence at 5 p.m. this afternoon. This is essential, everyone, that we do.
The Queensland Premier said the lockdown is a protective measure and will be reviewed on Wednesday night. During the lockdown, Brisbane residents will only be able to leave their homes for essential works. Masks will be mandatory across the state. The recent outbreak is the first cluster of community transmissions in almost a month in Australia's third largest city. Brisbane, which is home to over 2 million people, has seen very few locally transmitted cases since the pandemic hit Australia. Australia has so far reported over 29,000 cases and 909 deaths. Health officials in Paris say hospitals in the French capital are fast approaching the saturation point due to snowballing COVID-19 admissions. The officials added that the hospitals may be forced to turn patients away in the coming days or weeks and urged the government to impose a new lockdown, including for schools. Separately, over 40 hospitals' crisis directors wrote an open letter asking the government to do more to curb the crisis. They said they were preparing for decisions on which patients should be granted access to intensive care. Currently, France has a total of around 28,000 COVID-19 patients in hospitals. The overall death toll of the coronavirus in the country stands above 94,000. Correspondent in Paris, Kristen Hunt, says the French government is being criticized for implementing ineffective lockdowns and failing to properly support intensive care units in hospitals.
Top of hospital officials, they have two main critics. They say the French government has not been able or should take more restrictive measures like the lockdown and the curfew, because the actual lockdown is very flexible and does not really prevent people to be contaminated. A second critics is about the lack of intensive care units. I mean, after more than 1 year of COVID crisis, the French government is still not able to organize a decent intensive care in the main hospital sector.
Authorities in Mozambique say dozens of people were killed in coordinated attacks by militants on Wednesday.
Over the past 3 days, the defense and security forces have executed operative actions focused firstly on the rescue of hundreds of citizens, nationals and foreign, protection of citizens and their goods.
The raids took place in the town of Palma in the northern province of Cabo Delgado. Officials say the attacks forced the evacuation of thousands of survivors to safety in the provincial capital, Pemba. 7 people were also killed in an ambush during the operations to evacuate hundreds of locals and foreigners. Raids came after an announcement by French energy group Total that it will resume work on a major gas project near Palma. Total now says it has suspended the restart of its work. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack yet. In northern Africa, efforts are being made to refloat a giant container ship stuck across Egypt's Suez Canal after attempts to dislodge it failed on Saturday. Officials said some progress has been made as more tugboats were joining the effort on Sunday. Alternative arrangements are also being put in place in case the operation fails. Egypt President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi has ordered preparations to lighten the load of the ship. More than 300 ships are stuck on either side of the blockade, and some vessels have had to reroute around the African continent. Authorities have warned it might take weeks before the canal is fully reopened. 15% of the world's shipping traffic transits the Suez Canal. To East Asia now, and the European Union has condemned as unacceptable deadly violence meted out to civilians by the Myanmarese military. EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell said the Saturday killing of more than 100 people by the military was a day of horror and of shame. U.S. President Joe Biden also said the situation in Myanmar was absolutely outrageous. Saturday marked the bloodiest day of the rallies since Myanmar's military coup on February the 1st. At least 450 people have been killed since the army seized power and detained de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The army claimed voter fraud in November of 2020 elections won by Madame Suu Kyi's party. Still in East Asia, North Korea has slammed the United Nations Security Council for branding the country's latest missile tests a violation of the world body's resolutions. Pyongyang said the meeting of the council's sanctions committee was designed to negate North Korea's right to self-defense. It also described the criticism as double standard on the part of the 15-member council and a direct product of the United States' hostile policies. A country test-fired two newly developed tactical guided missiles last week. The test prompted Washington to call for a Security Council meeting in which it demanded more sanctions be imposed on Pyongyang. That's it for me.
Congratulations to everyone on the 15th of Shaban, the birthday anniversary of the Imam of the Age, Abu Saleh al-Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Nowruz Special. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Today is the birth anniversary of the promised savior of mankind, Imam Mahdi, may God expedite his reappearance. Today is a great feast for the entire creation. Today is the birthday of the man who will liberate mankind from injustice, corruption, and ignorance. He will come to guide mankind toward knowledge and servitude of God. Congratulations on this auspicious day, and we invite you to listen to a special program on this occasion. The corrupt and oppressive Abbasid rulers knew that a man from the progeny of the Prophet by the name of Mahdi would stand up to destroy the palaces of injustice and despotism. That's why, from the era of Imamat of Imam Muhammad Taqi al-Jawad, Imam Mahdi's great-grandfather, they intensified their pressures against the Prophet's progeny. These pressures culminated in the era of the Imam's father, Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him. Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him, spent nearly all of his life under surveillance of the Abbasid tyrants in the city of Samarra in Iraq. The spies of the regime had the Imam's commutations under constant monitoring, and they had even assigned some midwives to control the family of the Imam to be aware of any pregnancy and kill any child that would be born. But as the proverb goes, man proposes, God disposes. The pregnancy of Imam Mahdi's mother occurred like that of the Prophet Moses' mother without any signs of pregnancy. The Israelites had assigned inspectors to monitor pregnant women in killing male children. But God safeguarded Moses and he was born secretly. In the same way, till a few hours before the birth of Imam Mahdi, even the nearest women folk of Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him, were unaware of the pregnancy of his wife, Lady Narges, peace upon her. Lady Hakim Khatun, the paternal aunt of Imam Hassan Askari, related, "On the eve of mid-Sha'ban, my nephew Imam Hassan invited me to his house and told me, 'This night God will reveal the man who is his vicegerent on the earth.' I said, 'May God sacrifices me for you. By God, there is no sign of pregnancy in Lady Narges.' He said, 'The affair is the way that I said.' She continued, 'Near the dawn, Narges woke up and told me to help her for childbirth. I started reciting Surah Qadr. As I reached the phrase, Salamun hiya hatta matla al-fajr, the child was born. I wrapped him in a cloth and took him to Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him. From the very beginning, as if there was written on Imam Mahdi's arm, "The truth has come and falsehood has vanished. Indeed, falsehood is bound to vanish. جَاءَ الْحَقُّ وَزَهَقَ الْبَاطِلُ إِنَّ الْبَاطِلَ كَانَ زَهُوقًا." Imam Mahdi not only was born in a different way, but also lived a different life. Shortly after his father's martyrdom, he was hidden from eyes. Of course, his going into occultation does not mean that he is not among people. He lives among people and attends their gatherings, but they do not see him. Imam Mahdi is quite aware of the affairs of people. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says in this regard, "By the Lord of Ali, during the occultation period that people have fallen in erroneous thoughts, God's vicegerent is among them and walks in their alleys and market. He enters their homes and travels to the east and west of the world. He hears their words, goes to their gatherings, and greets them." Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, also says, "The Imam of the age attends the season of Hajj every year. He sees the Hajis, but they do not see him." It is noteworthy that Imam Mahdi, peace upon him, is among the people, and his being hidden from the eyes does not prevent the faithful to enjoy his presence and seek his help. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, on the era of Imam Mahdi's occultation, "By God, who gave the mission of prophethood, people in the era of his occultation will get light from his velaya and will benefit from him." In Ayah 33 of Surah Tawbah, we read, "It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheist should be averse." This ayah gives the good news that Islam will eventually overcome all religions and will prevail in the entire world. The Noble Quran is the global law. It is the most perfect book and guidance for mankind. No error enters it, and it is the perpetual law for the best way of living in this world and salvation in the hereafter. Imam Mahdi, peace upon him, is the global leader who will reform all human affairs. His reappearance requires global readiness. Unfortunately, the conditions are not prepared for that great event. There are still ignorant people who think that worldly powers can salvage them. The majority of people in the world have realized the falsity and inefficacy of different man-made rules and hollow promises of various governments. the promised savior of mankind, will reappear when the whole earth calls him and seeks him unanimously. We pray to God to place us among those who set the ground for his reappearance through removing obstacles and struggling against tyrants and oppressors which are represented by the U.S., the Zionist regime, and their partners in crime in Europe, and their flunkies among Arab regimes of West Asia.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Economic divide.
Hello and welcome to Economic Divide with Mika Batafwai. In this week's episode, we will look at the illegal arms trade and its economic impact, specifically which countries top the list in this trade and whether the intentions of these countries are to derail the government in charge for their own political gains. Data from CIPRI's Arms Industry Database shows that arms sales by the world's 25 largest arms producers actually rose to $361 billion for the year 2019. This represented an 8.5% increase in real terms over the arms sales for the year 2018. By the way, we're going to feature an interview I had with the world-famous CIPRI Institute President Jan Eliasson. Now, taking a look at the country known for huge military sales, the U.S., the U.S. does not even hide the fact that arms transfers have been a primary instrument of their foreign policy since the Nixon Doctrine. Additionally, the U.S. says it's an easy way to win friends and to influence people. Well, perhaps none of that is new, but it is worth noting why we thought there should be a program on this. Because not only are the weapons falling into the wrong hands, economies, they're getting destroyed in the process. Our first report, a look at an alarming development involving arms and the famous military contractor Z Services, formerly known as Blackwater. Private security contractor and ally of former U.S. President Donald Trump, Eric Prince, was back in the news, and again for the wrong reasons.
It's that these weapon sales, as you said, got the okay from the U.S. authorities, or from some authorities.
It violated a U.N. arms embargo on Libya. A confidential report to the Security Council said that Prince deployed a force of foreign mercenaries and weapons to strongman Khalifa Haftar, who has fought to overthrow the U.N.-backed Libyan government in 2019. The $80 million operation included plans to form a hit squad to track and kill Libyan commanders opposed to Haftar. Eric Prince offered to supply weapons, drones, and mercenaries to a Libyan militia commander seeking to overthrow the government.
Is being continued by the British and the Biden administration that they implement probably to destabilize the talks that are going on now to create a unified government.
Libya has been a source of illicit weapons transfer for Africa, especially to northern Africa. These are some of the documented flows of weapons and non-state armed personnel in the Sahel from the years 2011 through 2017, which concentrate on North Africa. It is no surprise that conflict remains Africa's biggest challenge, with such quantities of illicit arms flowing in the continent. Joining me in the studio is Current Affairs and Impact Analyst Mahan Abedin. And we also have Carl Osgood, who's the editor of EIR Executive Intelligence Review. Now, this is the weekly news publication of Lyndon LaRouche. He's also the Washington correspondent who has written on military affairs, veterans, health affairs, municipal affairs, homelessness, and other social issues. Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. Let me first start with you, Carl, and talk about how the topic of this program came about. Eric Prince, a Trump ally, to have violated the Libyan arms embargo based on a UN report. It said that Prince offered to supply weapons, drones, and mercenaries to Libya militia commander seeking to overthrow the government, according to UN investigators. Doesn't this imply that Prince was actually acting either on behalf of the U.S. government or got the okay from the U.S. government to go ahead with supplying these weapons and military equipment to advance the U.S. agenda, in this case in Libya?
Well, I mean, officially the U.S. government was actually supportive of the Tripoli government in Libya, not of Khalifa Haftar. As far as Prince goes, he probably thought he had government support because he was a supporter of Donald Trump, and his sister, Betsy DeVos, was Trump's education secretary.
Mahan, when we take a look at what happened here, the news that came out regarding Prince, I don't think he's a very well-liked person in some respects, but the U.S. government seems to fancy him. Now, do you agree, or do you get the sense that he's maybe doing the dirty work for the U.S. government, in this case in Libya? I mean, it was the U.S. that actually led NATO war in Libya, as you're well aware. It destroyed the country, destroyed its economy, and the U.S. is still not letting go of it.
Yeah, well, this is, Prince is like, he's the symbol, if you like, of this new form of warfare, subcontracting warfare to these private companies. Now, to be fair, many countries are doing it. It's not just the Americans. But what's making the American initiative so controversial is because it's just so messy, illegal, and so bloody. I mean, this guy, Prince, he's responsible for killing at least 17 Iraqis in a notorious incident in 2007.
All right. At this point, we're going to take a look at the second report and see who are these manufacturers that are selling and spreading their weapons around the world, especially when it comes to the West Asia region, where sales just keeps soaring and the U.S. continues to be the number one weapons supplier.
The world is awash with weapons. Amnesty and other rights groups have always highlighted this.
Every year, around $100 billion worth of weapons are traded around the world.
There are clear rules against arms transfers to third parties. Being the top arms manufacturer in the world, does the U.S. monitor where its arms end up? Time and again, U.S. military equipment has been transferred from Saudi Arabia and the UAE to a variety of militias, including some linked to Al-Qaeda.
Is the policy pushed again by the British and the American administration to have endless wars in the Middle East. This dates back to 1996 when Tony Blair, at a speech in Chicago, said, we have to end the sovereignty of nation states. This is dangerous for us. And this is what they've been implementing in the Middle East. And that's what the weapon sales are about.
The U.S. also has a history of supplying weapons and military training to regimes that commit deaths and, in some cases, massacres, like Saudi Arabia and Israel. The issue of Israel's trade with rogue regimes has been thrust into the spotlight after revelations that it was sending weapons to Myanmar in defiance of a U.S. and European arms embargo. Israeli firms have also broken with the U.S. and Europe by supplying weapons and surveillance equipment to militias in South Sudan.
We're prepared to give evidence of massive criminal behavior by the president of South Sudan.
and by his opposition, the ousted vice president of South Sudan and their generals. The simple fact is, they're stealing the money to fund their militias to attack and kill one another. The evidence is thorough, it is detailed, and it is irrefutable. It involves arms dealers, international lawyers, international banks, international real estate.
Back with me in the studio is Mahan Abedin and Carl Osgood, editor of EIR Executive Intelligence Review. Welcome, gentlemen. Carl, the illicit weapon sales effects are seen in conflict zones, especially in West Asia or the Middle East. The U.S. Is in many of these conflict zones. U.S. military manufacturers hold the top spots for weapons manufacturers. Does this by default mean that the U.S. is behind illicit weapons sales, either directly, covertly, or otherwise? I mean, please note that numerous reports have revealed, for example, that U.S. weapons have actually fallen into the wrong hands, like Al-Qaeda, through U.S. allies like Saudi Arabia or the UAE.
Well, of course, the U.S. has been indirectly involved in illicit weapon sales, but the U.S. is hardly the only country that does this. There's British weapons, French weapons, Israeli weapons. Israeli weapons have been found in Syria. The Syrian government keeps turning up caches of weapons in areas formerly controlled by jihadi groups that include weapons from the U.S. and weapons from Israel. But also there are Chinese weapons, Russian weapons, and probably weapons from a lot of other places as well. And I recall that there were reports in 2013 about how the CIA was involved in running weapons, not American-made weapons, but Russian-made weapons from Eastern Europe to jihadi groups in Syria. So The manufacturer of a weapon that ends up in the hands of a jihadi militant doesn't tell you the whole story. He might be carrying an AK-47, but the AK-47 could have been arrived as a result of networks run by the CIA and other intelligence agencies. So it's, like I said, it's a murky world, and it's really more complicated than merely identifying the make of the weapon.
Yes, a murky world indeed. Mahan, I want to take up with you the whole notion of arms ending up in the wrong hands. Accidents?
Your guest has a point, up to a point. Weapons ending up in the hands of insurgent or terrorist groups. Just looking at the origin of a weapon just tells you only part of the story. But I find it hard to believe, though, that this isn't somehow by design. I mean, there may be one or two cases where mistakes are made. Syria was a good example where the Americans, through the CIA, were actually arming one faction, but then this faction was defeated by a more hardline faction and they took over the weapons. Things like that happen. But the intelligence networks that are involved in this game, they know what they're doing. And of course, they arm certain groups or certain factions in order to advance their country's foreign policy. And again, where I would disagree with your guest, again, is the U.S. is an exception, actually, simply because, one, as I said before, the scaled-up nature of these activities. And also the fact that, the private armies that the U.S. is now seems to be promoting, sometimes they have a roguish agenda, because usually mercenary forces, they complement the forces of a state actor. They don't go rogue. Let's say a country is weak. It needs foreign mercenaries to come in to beef up its operations. But in Libya, for example, Prince, his group had a budget of $80 million. That's really quite significant in the mercenary world. And it just goes to show that they're running rogue operations, again, in pursuit of very distinct U.S. foreign policies. Now, what the U.S. objective in Syria was, we're not quite sure at the moment.
Don't know what it is.
Yeah, but that's where I think the U.S. involvement is more prominent than other countries.
All right.
Yeah.
Thanks to you, Mahan, and Carl Osgood. Yeah. At this point, we're going to take a short break here on Economic Divide. But don't go anywhere, as we have plenty more coming up. So stay right where you are. Welcome back to Economic Divide with me, Kava Tahwai. Time now to take a look at some of the other economic headlines hitting the front pages in our Info News section. Our first item concerns food waste and distribution. capitalist economies overproducing food. Says the problem isn't that there isn't enough food to actually go around for everybody, but that more and more people are unable to afford to purchase it. That indeed is a big problem. On to another persistent problem, the garment industry. Brands and retailers that made a profit for the year 2020 could stop garment workers going hungry. And how can they do that? They can set up a severance fund by paying the equivalent of just 10 cents per t-shirt. Makes you think about it, doesn't it? Okay, next up, Syria's civil war. It started a decade ago. Now, this is what has happened. The Syrian people are being crushed from Western sanctions. It's known as the Caesar Act, the most recent one. Also, sanctions are harming the Syrian people. Obviously, the economy is suffering as a result. On to our final report. This goes to another war, the Yemen conflict, 6 years old since the Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S., actually attacked it, speeding towards a massive famine is what the U.N. has said. And, of course, then the economic collapse as a result has been a major driver of instability in that country. Okay, time now to take a look at our final report of the show, which looks at how there's a huge disparity between what arms-producing countries preach, which is peace, when in actuality it is arms sales that are the main drivers, namely money to fill in their coffers for as long as anyone can remember.
War is a racket, and nobody knows that better than the U.S. The U.S. military budget is more than 10 countries combined.
Not just the weapons manufacturers, which themselves are controlled by powerful financial organizations on Wall Street, but it's also a policy establishment. You have the think tanks, and the people from these think tanks go in and out of various administrations when the president changes. You know, you've heard about the neoconservatives. They're the extreme right wing of this establishment.
As long as conflicts continue, U.S. military sales will also continue. The controversy is in the conflicts themselves. Who's starting them? The U.S.'s so-called war on terror was a gift to the U.S. to not only expand its military bases, but to put in overdrive its military sales. It was recently disclosed that the Pentagon had expanded its secretive so-called war on terror to 80 countries. Meanwhile, the armed conflicts have cost the world economy dearly, $14.1 trillion in 2019.
Please welcome back one more time current affairs and impact analyst Mahan Abedin and Carl Osgood, editor at the EIR. Welcome back to you both. Carl, the saying the war is a racket, something you're familiar with, I'm sure. The U.S. military budget, for example, is more than 10 countries combined. Military sales, big money makers, obviously, for the U.S. Is it correct to conclude that as long as conflicts continue, U.S. military sales will continue? The U.S. foreign policy perhaps may want to perpetuate these conflicts in which basically it has been called a war economy for the U.S.
Okay. Well, you know, Eisenhower, when he was his last speech before leaving the presidency, spoke of the military-industrial complex, and he warned that this thing could gain so much power that it would be deciding policies, and that is what has happened. Even Donald Trump spoke against that. U.S. weapon sales do help drive conflicts. But again, like I said before, this is not just the U.S. involved in this. There's also, I mean, the British practically invented this trade, the British Empire. There were hearings in the U.S. Congress in the 1920s about how British were selling weapons to both sides in various conflicts. So this is an old problem. And it has to be, you know, this is one of those things that has to be overthrown if we want to improve the relations among nations.
Okay, Mahan, war is a racket is a saying that's been prevalent in the U.S. I mean, we get it. But how about the downside? I mean, we're looking at forever wars, economies obliterated all over the world in terms of where the U.S. is involved in one form or another, lives to have shattered. Any hope on the horizon to stop the U.S. on this war footing? if you may.
Well, again, your guest has a point up to a point. It's not just the U.S. that's involved in this racket. There are many players. And I think the bigger picture here, actually, is that warfare is in transition. Countries like the U.S. that can afford it, they are going to subcontract the uglier side of warfighting, if you like. And, I mean, again, your guest brought up the U.K. The U.K. brought up, actually released its integrated review of foreign and defense security policy just last week, where, you know, the focus is on developing lighter, nimbler forces, if you like, to carry out operations. And just yesterday, the British, for example, announced the creation of a new special operations force. So I think what we've seen in terms of mercenary fighting forces, this is actually going to increase in the future. It's not going to decrease, unfortunately.
Thank you very much for that. Mohan Abedin, Current Affairs and Impact Analyst, thank you for your thoughts. And we also like to thank Carl Osgood from the Executive Intelligence Review. Time now for 1,000 Words. SIPRI, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, released the latest figures of its internal arms sales. There were both hope and disappointment. It said international arms transfers have actually leveled off after years of sharp growth. That is the good news. The bad news? West Asia or the Middle East arms imports grew the most. From what we can see here, the arms imports, as it's just stated, have grown by a lot. Substantial increases in transfers happened with three of the top five arms exporters. Now, this graph over here shows just what we talked about in terms of how the West Asia Middle East arms imports have grown the most from the years 1981 through 85 all the way down through 2016 to 2020. And you can see how it has leveled off based on what SIPRI has said. Well, as I mentioned before in our program, I had the pleasure of interviewing the SIPRI chairman, Dr. Jan Eliasson, at our studios during the Tehran Dialogue Forum. First, this is what he said about the most recent report that we just covered from his institute.
I want to start by telling you that I am chair of the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, and yesterday we published the latest report on arms trade. And it is interesting that it seems like arms trade is leveling off. It is already on a huge scale, of course, but what is disturbing is, if I refer to your region, the wider Middle East, you have an increase of 25% of arms through to the region in the period 2016 and 20. It is a huge export, led mostly by major powers. But it is also a sign, apropos what we just heard in the introduction, of a lack of trust, and that too much in today's world is based on trying to base security on military means, defense in the military sense.
Basing security on military means and a lack of trust is what you said. Interesting. However, to the military manufacturers, does trust translate to sales, to revenues, or to dollars or euros? I don't think so. Anyways, this is what I asked them, which included SIPRI's latest report.
Well, thank you very much. One of my major points is, of course, that we have a chance, we have an opportunity now, in a strange and paradoxical way. We need to think about the world after COVID-19. What kind of world would we want to create? And we have the chance to do that. There is a new change, there's a change of administration in the US, and there is awareness that we need to take different directions. And I think we need to focus very strongly now on reducing this enormous mistrust.
The SIPRI chairman, Dr. Jan Eliasson, there with his comments. Banking on COVID to change the country selling arms, like he said the new U.S. administration. Well, word of advice there, don't bank on it. Okay, I'm going to be right back now with my ending thoughts. The world is in a transition. COVID-19 has decimated economies around the world. Enough of wars. The war that needs to be won is against the pandemic and to overcome all the economic shortfalls and devastation, which is the consequence of these wars. But where there's money, there will be arms, and the U.S. stands there number one on the list, both in terms of manufacturing arms and the sales of arms. If it's not selling it, it is providing huge sums of money in the form of foreign assistance. In the case of Israel, for example, it provides it with around $4 billion in military assistance each year. I would like to end the program with these thoughts by the Iranian foreign minister, which puts forward the notion of arms inequality into perspective.
The United States is selling billions, $50 billion last year, sold $50 billion of weapons to this region. Some of the countries in this region, with less than a third of our population, spend $87 billion on just military procurement. Let's just compare. Iran spent last year $16 billion on all of its military, with almost a million people under arms. We paid $16 billion. The United Arab Emirates, with a total 1 million population, indigenous population, spent $22 billion. Saudi Arabia spent $87 billion. Now, if you're talking about threats coming from countries in the region, the threat is coming from the United States and its Western allies, who are pouring weapons into this region.